And so that was my mindset, my thought, you know, I'm treat you like you're my son. And I saw it as a responsibility that, you know, every guy that walked in the room, every guy that I coached, I felt I had a responsibility, you know, with that guy. And so God had put him in front of me for a reason. And I was just going to make sure that the impact was positive.
Welcome to What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest is Sherman Smith. And I recently got to hear Sherman's story and hear him speak at the Father's Day service at our church here in Louisville, which will make sense why he spoke on the Father's Day service as you hear his story. Sherman played in the NFL for 8 seasons and coached for over 30 years, including being the offensive coordinator of the Washington Redskins at the time and winning a Super Bowl as a coach with the Seahawks. You will be impacted greatly by this man, and I cannot wait for you to hear his words that he shares on this episode. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you tune in weekly. Thanks and enjoy. Sherman, welcome to the show, my brother.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and us both being Ohio guys, we could likely just sit here right now and talk about Ohio high school football and how great it is. And we could sit here, but that probably wouldn't be as appealing to most of the people tuning into this podcast as the rest of your story is. So I want to start this way. You coached at a time when Seattle had the loudest fans in the league. You know, I played there on a Monday night and deafening noise out there in Seattle. But when you were drafted there in the second round back in 1976, they were an expansion team. What was the fan support like back then?
I tell you what, Eric, it was the same. Back in 1976, our fans were loyal. They came out there, you know, they knew we were an expansion team and we were halfway decent. We gave them a show on offense because we had Jim Zorn and Steve Largent, you know, so we had some guys that could, you know, do some good things. And our fans were out there cheering us on all the time. And so when we went back there to coach in 2010 with Pete Carroll, it was just a carryover from what I remember when I played.
That's incredible to hear. And quickly, you played quarterback in college and then get drafted and end up at running back in the NFL. 6'4", 225 pounds. I understand they called you the tank back then. But how tough was that transition to running back?
It was very interesting. Like you said, Eric, I was a quarterback in college, but I got drafted as a wide receiver.
Wow.
So here it is. You know how the draft. So the draft happened in March or whatever it was, and I'm working out as a wide receiver. And I'm going to, you know, I'm mini camp. I'm a wide receiver. Get to training camp, and the day before camp starts, Jack Patera walks up to me and says, "Have you been looking at the running back plays?" And I laughed, and I said, "No, because I'm a wide receiver." He said, "Not anymore. We move you to running back." And so, man, it was fun. I'm going to tell you what, I got a lot of my coaching thoughts from my experience of being placed as a running back because my running back coach at that time, Andy McDonald, he did a great job of taking a guy that had never played the position since Little League football, teaching me some of the basic stuff, and then relying on me, you know, for some of my own abilities. But it was a great experience. They said they were going to take it slow. The very first practice, you know how it is, Eric, we had a 9-on-7, and I'm standing in the background because he said he's going to take it slow. And the running back coach said, "Get in there." I said, "What do you mean get in there? Hey, you said you're going to take it slow." And he laughed. He said, "I lied to you." You know, so we laughed about it. So here it is. I'm lined up in a 9-on-7, 7.5 yards deep in an NFL camp, having to play running back since Little League football. So it was an experience.
Oh, I guarantee it. But being adaptable like that in the NFL becomes so valuable. I played center all through college, get drafted by the Bills. They stick me at guard for a year and a half and got the opportunity to go back to center, which I was grateful for because I felt like I was a better center. But we had just picked up a center in free agency, so my spot, my chance to get on the field was at guard. Now, that is much different than going from quarterback to receiver to running back, but being adaptable in the NFL is so valuable, and it's so valuable in life. There's so many times in life that you have to be adaptable to situations. But with your experience, all that experience as a coach as well as an NFL player, I'm dying to ask you, what would be your top advice for rookies transitioning in the NFL that want to have a successful career like you had yourself?
Well, I think, like I say, you have to be coachable. You have to recognize that you don't know everything that you think you know. I know you had a great career in college and all that other stuff, but just being prepared to learn and being humble and being hungry and wanting to know, you know, as much about the game as you can, and just working hard and being committed to being the very best you can be each and every day. And I think you'll get great coaching in the NFL, wherever, you know, but just being coachable. That's the thing I found in coaching guys when they came to the league. Some of them thought they knew more than you knew. And, you know, for them to be humbled and for them to realize they didn't know as much as they thought they did.
Yep, you're exactly right. And there's a humility that you have to have when you step into an NFL facility, understanding that these coaches do know more than you, that you're surrounded by grown men and a lot of guys in the locker room that you can learn a lot from as well. And you could be coaching exactly amongst your peers as well. And then can you also have the confidence to then go play with the big boys at the highest level?
That's right. And that's what you find out, Eric, when you get to the NFL, everyone is good.
Yes.
All of these guys can play, you know, all of them, you know, they got some statistics also. So don't think you're the big man on campus. You can get away with that in high school and in college, but when you get to the NFL, man, it levels out real quick and you find out, man, there's some guys that can play, you know? And so you have to have more than just physical talent. You got to be that guy that's dependable, you know, hey man, we can trust this guy. He's going to do the right thing, you know, let alone have some physical talent as well.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And you mentioned everybody's good. It's funny. When I first got to the Bills, one of the guys on our practice squad who I was going against on a day-to-day basis, when I'm coming off of a game sore, the guy I'm going against on our practice squad was one of the best defensive tackles. He went to the University of Kentucky. He was one of the best guys I played against in college. Now he's on our practice squad. That's who I got to go against on a day-to-day basis. But if you show up and do the work every day, now you're going to get that much better because you are going against the best of the best daily. And I got to ask you this, because you coached Hall of Famers and you played with, you know, some of the greats of all time. Besides work ethic and physical ability, was there anything that you saw in them that truly separated them from the rest?
Well, you know, I know the big name players that are very recognizable to people that I coach: Eddie George, Heisman Trophy winner, Marshawn Lynch, you know, those guys right there. I just know Eddie, Eric, we drafted him, you know, so he comes out of college, he's a Heisman Trophy winner. And you know, like I said, besides athletic ability, you could just tell his work ethic, his character. He had a different mindset about how he went about his business. I remember we were at training camp here in Tennessee, and it was hot. And, you know, we were working hard, and the guys were tired. And so we're in a meeting room, and all these guys are really kind of complaining. You know, oh, man, it sure is hot. I'm tired. I'm sore. We're working hard. And they're waiting for Eddie George, Heisman Trophy winner, rookie of the year, four-time Pro Bowler, to say something and validate it. And this is what he said that made me understand and made them understand why he is the kind of guy he was. Eddie turned around to him and said, hey, look here, guys, it's training camp. It's supposed to be hot. Mm. You're supposed to be tired. We're supposed to work hard. This is what gets us ready. And I said, see, man, what you see as a problem, he sees as preparation. And so that was his mindset, man. He competed against those elements. And Eddie was the one player that I would tell any rookie, just follow him, do what he does, follow his example in everything, because the way he carried himself, you know, how hard he worked, his, you know, just everything about him was just stupendous. And Marshawn was the same way. You know, Marshawn was a different type of guy, you know, but he was a leader in his way, showed up to work every day and had that mindset. Somebody asked him about being called beast mode. And one guy said, well, I'm gonna go home and, you know, I get into beast mode. And Marshawn said, no, beast mode is already inside of you. You know, you don't get into beast mode. And so, you know, hey, Marshawn, why do you run the way you run? He said, because I run not to get tackled. You know, a different mindset. So these guys thought differently and it transitioned into the way they play.
Man, I love that story about Eddie George. And I used to tell guys that were real excited at the start of training camp and they'd run their mouth early on. I said, find me day five, find me day 10. I'm still gonna be chirping and you're gonna be feeling sorry for yourself. But I always used to tell the old lineman, and you know, at the NFL, especially with you coaching offensive coordinator, running back, you understand that, you know, in college, you can dominate some guys, but in the NFL, yes, a lot of times a stalemate's a win. You know,
that's
if
right.
Your guy doesn't make the tackle, that's a win. And I would tell the offensive line when it got real cold in Buffalo, or if it got real hot and we're playing down in Miami in September, I'd say these are the games that you could put up a highlight reel now, because someone's
right.
going to feel sorry for themselves and it ain't going to be us.
That's
and,
right. You know, there you go.
And so that's
there
what I would go. Try to tell the O-line. I love that from Eddie George. And I got the pleasure to play with Marshawn, and, you know, a pretty misunderstood guy for the most part in the media. And I think now people are starting to see his personality a little bit more and understand him just a little bit. But I used to always laugh because Marshawn, you know, talk about having beast mode in him. He, you know, during practice, he wasn't necessarily all the time going to, you know, waste his energy. And, mm-hmm. And you might not see that game day beast mode in practice, but I remember our first game, we're at New England on Monday Night Football, and Marshawn is laughing after he got tackled one time. And, you know, probably an 8-yard gain, and I go to help him up because I always took pride in being the guy that would help up the running back. So I go help him up, and he's laughing. I said, "Why are you laughing?" He said, "Do you see how bad I made Mayo miss? He's a clown." And he's just out there having fun. But, man, truly, truly a special player.
I love coaching the guy. I really did. I remember I told him I worked him out when he was coming out of college, you know, went down to Cal and worked him out. And I knew he was a special talent then. And when we traded for him, Eric, I mean – man, I was excited. And I got out there. He was the one guy that I felt every time he touched the ball, I thought he could score a touchdown.
Yep.
And I told the players, I said, "You might not like hearing me say this, but I wouldn't take him off the field. If it was up to me, he'd never come off the field. But as far as his personality and giving, loyal, I mean, he was a leader in our facility. When Marshawn spoke, everybody listened. You know, he was the guy. If there was something going on, go to Marshawn. He'll get it straightened out for you.
Yep.
So I love the guy.
You're exactly right. And one thing that really stood out to be about Marshawn was how smart he was. I mean,
exactly.
Yes. In Buffalo, we fired our offensive coordinator after our third preseason game my rookie year. And now we're running kind of a new offense. That next year, Chan Gailey comes in. We got a whole new offense. So really three offenses in about a year and a half. And Marshawn was one of the first to pick him up. He, you know, as far as protections go, just, I mean, he was unbelievably smart. And that's what stood out to me as well. And that's a lot of the greats. And I don't care what they got under their Wonderlic, but you put them in a football room and they
get them
help so quick.
Yeah. Well, I know this. The other thing about him too, Eric, was he took a great deal of pride. He did not like making mistakes. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to have any busts, no mental errors. And I was fortunate when we got him in Seattle, I kind of said to him, like I said to Eddie George, I said, "You're the leader of this group. Rather than if you don't want, it doesn't make no difference. You're the leader. And if you don't do it, they won't do it." I said, "So how can I demand from them to go 20, 25 yards down the field with the ball if you don't do it?" And he complied and he went down the field and he led by example. And, you know, and it transitioned in the way he played. So he was a beautiful guy. And like you say, smart. And, you know his story. I think he's still living off of his money that he made for promotions. He still hasn't spent a dime of his salaries in all the years that he's played. Great with his money. Like you said, smart, really smart, smarter than people think.
Yep. And I know he didn't blow a bunch of money on clothes because we invited him in for the Kentucky Derby and he's all set to come to the Derby. And we told him, "Hey, you have to at least wear a sport coat in. You don't have to keep it on. You don't have to wear a tie, but you have to wear a sport coat." He said, "Nah, I ain't wearing a sport coat." I said, "All you got to do is put it on. You can wear one of mine and just put it over whatever you want." He said, "I'm not coming anymore." I said, "I love it, dude. You're you, and I love you for it. I love you."
That's the guy.
Yeah. What led you into the coaching profession after you were done playing?
Well, I tell you what, I knew I wanted to be a coach when I was in high school. And really for me, Eric, it was my high school coach, Clifton Knox. He came to my high school probably when I was about in the eighth grade. He took a program that was one of the losingest programs in the state of Ohio, and he turned that program around. And the way he did it was he changed the school from the inside out. He talked to, you know, like they say, it's not about the X's and O's, but the Jimmys and Joes.
Yep.
How he dealt with the Jimmys and Joes and the Marys and the Janes. I mean, all the students. He came to our community and talked to us about having pride in yourself, pride in your school, pride in your community. He talked to us about how we looked at ourselves, what impact how we looked at others. And that's what changed us. And we became a championship school because of that. And I was sitting in the back of his health class one day, and I said, "Man, that's what I want to be, man. I want to be a coach. And I want to make a difference the way Coach Knox has made a difference in my life and the life of my teammates and my classmates." And that was it. So for me, when I left high school to go to Miami of Ohio on scholarship, I went there because it was called the Cradle of Coaches.
Yes.
I just wanted to be a coach. Playing professional football was something that I had not planned on doing. You know, I just knew I wanted to be a coach. So when my career was over with, I was kind of excited because I could start doing what I really wanted to do when I left to go to college.
It's amazing how many big time coaches have come out of Miami, Ohio. I called one of their games for ESPN a couple of years ago, and I was running through their program and all the materials they sent me. And every time you get this big portion of their God dedicated to all the former coaches that have come from Miami, Ohio, and it's truly remarkable. What makes it so? Is it kind of in the culture to where everybody's pouring into each other, or what makes Miami, Ohio this hot?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, it's just because it has that name, Cradle of Culture. So when you go there, there's an expectation of how, you know, how you'll go about your business, and how I think every sport, the basketball coach, the baseball coach, everyone, we kind of get together and talk about how we coach guys, and, you know, and just had great head coaches. You know, I had Bill Mallory as my head coach for 2 years, and Dick Crum, and had great assistant coaches around me and, you know, coaching me. So I was just surrounded by great guys, great people. You know, that's the thing I loved about our coaches at Miami. They were good coaches, but good people also.
Yeah, so I would personally love to get into coaching. I would love to be in an NFL facility again. Heck, if it was front office, I would love to do that. The one thing holding me out right now is I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old at home, and I just feel like the time commitment would be too much for me. How did you and your wife manage that while you were coaching?
Well, man, I tell you, so my wife got a lot of practice. You know, when I was coached 5 years of college ball before I got in the NFL. So the time that you're on the road recruiting and all of that. So my wife was built for it. You know, she's independent enough where she can handle when I'm not there. And, you know, but I know she appreciated the times that I was there. And it was just getting my kids and my wife understood, particularly when I got to the NFL, the time commitment that it took. And, you know, I was going to spend as much time with them as I could. You know, that's why I didn't play golf and all the other stuff. When I had free time, I was at home with my kids and my wife, and they understood that. And they enjoyed certain aspects of the life, NFL coaching. They enjoyed some of the stuff that went along with it. So they gave me a break when it came to those times, particularly during the season. But I was really fortunate, Eric, that the coaches that I coached for in the NFL, Jeff Fisher and Pete Carroll, those guys really during the offseason, they understood the commitment that we made during the season. And they made the offseason beautiful. You know, it was, you weren't allowed to miss any of your kids' events during the offseason. You know, we had somewhat regular hours during the offseason. And they always, you know, they counted for the times that they knew when we couldn't get away. And they made it very nice for us to have that time with our families during the offseason.
That's excellent to hear. I always joke that if Tony Dungy comes back and coaches, then I'll be putting my application in with him, because he always said you either have to take your children to school or be home for dinner. And dinner may not be at 6 o'clock, but you're going to be home for dinner if we're working that morning grind where one of the quotes I love, and I've heard you say it in regards to coaching, is when you would refer to your guys, and I know you made an impact on so many players by having this mindset, but you would say, you may not be looking for a father, but I'm going to treat you like my son. And to me, when you have that mindset of a coach, it becomes a lot less selfish with you being away from your family when you are truly impacting lives, when you have that mindset, and it's not this selfish ambition, this endless journey to fulfill something with a trophy. You're there to impact lives. So I truly loved hearing that quote from you.
Well, that's something I think that thought was developed as I grew up in Youngstown. You know, I knew my dad was my hero, you know, and so my dad was very involved in my life, but I also had other fathers in my life, you know, who were my coaches, my little league coaches. And they treated me like I was their son, even though they knew my father. And so I think that mindset came from them, how they dealt with me. They weren't responsible for putting clothes on my back and food in my stomach. But, man, they were giving me direction, encouragement. They were, you know, they would affirm me. They were doing all the things that my dad would do for me. And so that's where it came from. And I said, I want to coach you the way I would want somebody to coach my son, the way I'd want somebody to coach me, you know, with respect. You know, you can coach me hard, but, you know, there's a line that you don't cross as a coach. That I said I would never cross as a coach, and I would hope no one would cross that line with me. And so that was my mindset, my thought, you know, I'm gonna treat you like you're my son. And I saw it as a responsibility that, you know, every guy that walked in the room, every guy that I coached, I felt I had a responsibility, you know, with that guy. And so, you know, God, I felt, you know, God had put him in front of me for a reason. And I was just gonna make sure that the impact was positive. You know, like I said, coached him right. You know, when I say coach hard, you know, yeah, you're going to correct them and all the other stuff, you know, but there was a line I would not cross when it came to coaching players. I would never disrespect a player to the point where, you know, he felt offended by how I talked to him, you know, with disrespectful tone, calling him a name and stuff like that. I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. And I respect that in you. And I feel like nowadays coaches are becoming more adept to that. When you see these coaches that are rising through the ranks, it's the ones that, yes, you have to coach guys hard. That's what coaches are there to pull things out of you that you wouldn't naturally pull out of yourself. So there is an element of hard coaching, but yes, you do it in a respectful way.
That's exactly right.
And to me, that's been an awesome transition in coaching nowadays, where you see all these guys rising through the ranks that are treating guys with respect. And you talked about treating all your players like a son. And I'm going to encourage, and we're going to put a link in the show notes, and I'll put it out through my social media, and encourage people to check out your story on E60 and okay, read the articles through ESPN beforehand. But for all those listening, will you give the listeners a short version of the story that has now become famous through E60 and the film Show Me the Father? Will you give the short story of when one of your players, you found out later that you had a natural bond that you didn't know you had?
Yeah, man, that was a shock. You know, like I said, I started with that, you know, hey, you may not be looking for a father, but I'm going to treat you like you're my son. And so that was kind of my motto, my theme as I did all this coaching. You know, I was coaching high school football back in Seattle area, Redmond High School. And a teammate of mine at Miami of Ohio, Randy Walker, got the head job at Miami and called me up, and he says, hey, man, how about coming back to our alma mater? Let's get it back on the map, you know? And so, man, I was excited about going back to my school, beginning college coaching. And so I got a chance to recruit my hometown area, Youngstown, Ohio, and Campbell Memorial and all those places. So I go into Campbell Memorial and I start recruiting this running back. Guy weighed about 170 pounds, but man, he had some fire in him that we like, Dylan McCullough. So I recruit the guy, you know, and I coach him for 1 year, then I leave and I go to the University of Illinois. And we stayed in contact, you know, throughout the years, you know, so he was 18 years old when I recruited him. And we stayed in contact for 20 something years, you know, and just, he came out and did an internship in Seattle after we won the Super Bowl. And so we had this relationship, coach friend relationship. And so what happens one day, you know, he calls me up and he says, hey, you know, I was a, you know, I'm adopted. And I said, yeah, you know, and I'm thinking he's calling because it's around that time, you know, Eric, in November, that's when coaches start making those moves, college guys going to pros and all this other stuff. So I'm thinking that's what's going on with him. And he's talking about he was adopted and he got his birth record, found his birth mom and told me her name. And my heart dropped when he said her name. And before I could really process this, he said, and I asked her who my father was. And she said, it's you. And man, you know, it was like a bomb went off. I'm glad I was sitting down in my chair when he told me. I'd have been driving a car out on the road. It had been a head-on collision with someone because it just, boom, man, wow. And I think, you know, and so here it was making that statement to think, in fact, that I truly had coached a guy that was my son. But I knew this when I apologized to him, you know, as we got in the process, I apologized to him for, you know, my reckless and irresponsible behavior as a teenager. I didn't have to apologize to him for how I treated him. I knew I treated him the right way. And he told me that, he said, you treated me like a son. And he said that had an impact on him and our relationship. So therefore, you know, it became a reality in my life that a guy that I was coaching was indeed my son. And, you know, and so it came back to, there was some fruit that came from that.
Absolutely. And what a powerful story it is. I thought E60 did an incredible job of depicting that story. And
yes,
you guys all at a family reunion now. I mean, I would be lying if I wasn't sitting there bawling watching that at Southeast Christian Church when I got to see it on Father's Day. And
yeah,
how's your relationship with Dylan now? Obviously, your relationship's going to go to a different level, but you already had a close relationship before. What's changed in that relationship now?
Well, you know, it's really
besides
interesting.
Official,
you know,
besides an official title, does he call you dad or does he call you?
Yes, he does.
I love it.
I mean, he started that immediately. You know, it wasn't, you know, at first he asked my wife, what should I call him? You know, I call him coach or whatever. And Sharon told him, you'll figure it out. And he just, dad, you know, and that was fine with me. And so, you know, our relationship, you know, it was great before. And that's what he said, you know, Eric, when he called me, he said, He said, you know, I don't want anything from you. He said, if you are my father, that's great. We can build on our relationship. And if you aren't my father, that's fine. We have a relationship. And so now it's, you know, heck, he was going on 45 years old when I found this out. So he didn't need me to come in and father him, but I became a father to him. Mm. You know what I mean? So it was just, it was a father relationship. So at that point, I had my kids, you know, I had my daughter, you know, I believe at that time she was 40 years old, maybe, and my son was 38. And so, you know, when your kids get that age, you become more of a friend to them. You're a father, but it takes on sort of a friendship relationship also. So that's what it was for us. You know, it was just, we continued where we were at, and it was just, you know, I had the title. I'm his dad, his father, and he's my son. And so we would talk more about other things, family and all of that stuff. But, you know, it just deepened, and we talked more, and, you know, so it's been great. You know, I can just say it's been cool all the way.
Yeah. What a blessing. What a blessing that is. God sometimes has a funny sense of humor, and the fact that you recruit him, he comes to Miami, Ohio, and then you guys develop this relationship all along. And I understand along the way, there were some people telling you, like, Sherman, Elon looks like he's your son. Like, you guys look like, you sure that's not your son? Was there ever in the back of your mind any inkling that this could be my son?
Absolutely not, Eric. Right. You know, because in my mind, there was no reason to think that he should be, other than, you know, hey, man, you know what? You weren't very careful as a teenager. So, but other than that, no way, nothing. People tell us we looked alike. Oh, you talk alike. When he came up to Seattle and did an internship, Pat Rule, our offensive line, one of our offensive line coaches, his office right across from mine, and he came running across the hallway and said, look here, man, this is crazy. You guys have to be father and son. No way you're not father and son. And I get out of here, Pat. You know, man, you guys are always talking about we look alike and all that stuff. So just leave me alone with that stuff. I never thought it. Not at all. And, you know, looking at pictures of him after he told me that, you know, Carol said I was his father. Then I started looking at pictures of him, and all of a sudden I started looking at him. Man, we do look a little bit alike here, you know. So I started thinking, this might be for real. So people were telling us that, but I had no reason to think that was the case. You know, Carol didn't tell me, you know, when she was pregnant, that, hey, you know, I was pregnant. We had a son. I put him up for adoption and all the other stuff. If she had told me that, I might have said, man, I wonder if this is him, you know, but that didn't happen.
That's incredible. That cracks me up too. You thought Pat was being a little bit racist, and really he was being really observant.
No, yeah, and you know, I know Pat wasn't being racist. He's just funny, man. That's Pat, yeah. You know. And I, like I said, Pat's cool, man. And I knew where he was coming from because everyone else was saying it too.
Right.
You know, Marshawn and those guys were saying the same thing. You know, because Marshawn was there at that time, man, and Marshawn was saying it. So we had all kinds of people saying it, but we had no reason to think it was true.
Oh man, what a special story. And you're now a man of deep faith. Tell the listeners about how you got introduced to Christianity.
Well, you know, for me, I definitely growing up in Youngstown, I had a hunger and a desire to want to be a good man, a good person, you know, and I just knew, you know, going to church was part of what we did. And so just going to church and just wanting to know more. And so growing up, I'm a visual learner. And, you know, I just thought there had to be more to the Christian life than just going to church. And so, you know, people are speaking to me, telling me, man, you need to give your life to Christ and he can make a difference. And I'm looking at their life and I don't see much different in them than me, you know. Right. And so I'm saying, well, it doesn't look like Jesus Christ is making much of a difference in your life. And you're telling me what he can make a difference in mine. And so I just really had this hunger in my heart to want to know God. So the same hunger existed when I got to college. And I'm walking back to my dorm my junior year or maybe my senior year. It's late at night, and I look up at the stars, and I say, God, I just need somebody to show me. I need somebody to show me. And I think God knew the sincerity of my heart. I really desire to want to know who he was, but I need somebody to show me. And so I get drafted by the Seahawks, and I'm sitting in the cafeteria after Jack Patera just told me I was going to be a running back. So my head is kind of spinning, you know, like, man, like, now all these big guys are walking in. When I was a wide receiver, I didn't care how big they were because I figured I was going to be out there on the flank somewhere. I didn't have to worry about them.
Right.
So now I'm a running back. Those guys are walking in. I'm hoping all of them are offensive linemen, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So this one guy walks in, and he had big old black guy, big barrel chest, and he walks by on the back of his t-shirt and said, Hutch is going to Seattle to do God's battle. And I thought, oh man, I've come a couple thousand miles to run into another one of these so-called Christians. Mm. And I know at that time, God put it on my heart to watch this guy. And that's what I did. I watched him and didn't tell him I was watching him. And there was something different about him, something special, just the way he carried himself. He wasn't beating you over the head with the Bible. He was just loving on you. As a football player, man, he played hard. He was a linebacker. And I always tell people what he would tell us. He said, I'm going to play linebacker the way Jesus would play it. He would hit you and separate body parts and put you back together. He said, I won't be able to put you back together, but I'm going to try to separate body parts when I hit you. And that's how he played. So he was going to remove that notion that Christians were soft. He was going to make sure you didn't think that. And so he gets hurt in our last preseason game, Eric, you know, our rookie year, the first year of the Seahawks. You know, they tell us that his knee looked like it exploded when they x-rayed it. His career is over with. I go in the locker room. I want to comfort this guy and be a friend to him the way he's been to me. And he's got a smile on his face, ice packs on his knee, smile on his face. And I'm thinking, you know, he doesn't know who he is. You know, they gave him some good painkillers. And he said, Sherm, he said, I'm excited. He said, I'm excited to see what God has planned for my life. Mm. He said, you see, I'm a Christian and nothing happens in my life that's not filtered through God's hands first. And he just said, man, I'm excited. And I knew I didn't have that hope and that confidence that he had. And right there in that locker room, I said, would you please tell me more about Jesus Christ? And that's where he shared the gospel with me. You know, and at that moment, I didn't accept Christ. But later on, a couple months later, I did, because I had a knee injury. It wasn't nearly as serious as Hutch's, but I didn't have that hope and confidence that he had, and I wanted that. And I remember it was January 17th, 1977, on the corner of Madison and Broadway in Seattle, Washington. I prayed to receive Christ and come into my life, save me, you know, give me the hope and the confidence that Hutch has in you. Help me to know you, and you know, and that's where the journey began. And I tell the story, Eric, in my testimony. All those guys that were telling me what Jesus could do, and it didn't look like it was doing much for them. I became that person. I became that person that could talk the talk, but not walk the walk. And the same guy that led me to Christ was the same guy that came to me and asked me to do him a favor. And I said, anything for you. He said, would you please stop telling people you're a Christian? Wow. He said, you're making it tough on the rest of us who are trying to make a difference for Christ. Please stop telling people you're a Christian. The name of Jesus Christ is being ridiculed because of you. And I knew he was telling the truth. And I didn't get mad at him. Said, man, who are you to come at me like this? I knew this guy truly loved me, but I knew he loved the Lord more. And he loved me enough to tell me the truth. And that became a turning point in my Christian walk, because he asked me the question, don't you know who you are? And man, when he started telling me who I was in Christ, it helped me to recognize who I was without Christ. And it became a turning point in my mindset as a Christian. That, man, who I was made a difference. My identity made a difference. And so that's how the journey began for me.
Thank you very much for sharing that story. And we all need a Hutch in our life. And Sometimes you get multiple Hutches. Sometimes you need multiple Hutches. Those examples. But for me, I grew up Catholic, and then I got a little separate from my relationship, or really just the rules of Christianity. Following Catholicism growing up. Yeah. And I got to college. And I got to see a number of men, and I had prayed. I said, God, because I was seeking as well at the time. And I said, God, will you show me some Christian men in my life so I can see it? Yes, I want to see it. Right. And I got introduced to our FCA director at Louisville, Chris Morgan. Getting out of college, Ronnie Corgeray, who runs men's ministry at Southeast, who you got to meet, Dave Stone, a Kyle Ottoman. And I got to see these guys. And really what stood out to me was just how they treated people and how they acted on a day-to-day basis. And I said, man, there's a common denominator about the guys that I'm most drawn to on the Bills and most respect, these guys in Louisville who I respect the most and want to be like. There's one common denominator. Okay, Lord, thank you for all these people in my life. But we all need a Hutch as well, because yes, we are saved by God's grace, but you can turn people off towards Christianity by your actions. And that,
I believe it.
And yes, you are saved by grace, but your actions can negatively affect them. I always go back to Matthew 5:16, let your light shine before men so they'll praise your Father in heaven.
Mm-hmm. That's
not,
it.
Not beat people down to where they say,
that's right,
I want nothing of what Sherman or Hutch or Wood is talking about. And so
that's right.
Man, that's so powerful. In your journey, do you have a favorite verse that you come back to that's helped fuel you in your Christian walk?
Well, you know, there's so many of them for me, Eric, that, you know, some of them come in mind at certain times, just like in coaching.
Yes.
First Timothy chapter 2, verse 6 through 8. That comes into mind where God says to us, where Paul is talking to Timothy and Titus, excuse me. And he says to him, he says, encourage young men to be self-controlled in everything. Set them an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech so that those who condemn you will be ashamed because they have nothing evil to say about us. So in that verse, it employs me as a person, set them an example like we're talking about. Let them see it. Because if people believe what, if they believe what, if they like what they see, they might believe what you say, you know? And so when you start trying to encourage them about in the Christian walk, they like what they see, they might believe what you say to them. And so that's what I found one of my verses. And then, you know, Romans 12, 1, you know, where Paul says, man, because of God's mercy, you should present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God. So that's a motivation for me to say, man, when I think about God's mercy in my life, you know, that motivates me to say, man, you know what? Because of his mercy, you know, not give me what I deserve, man. That's a motivating factor for me to say, man, I want to live for Christ. You know, I want to be a difference maker the way he wants me to be. And like you said, Eric, it's not about, you know, that's something Hutch always said, what you do speaks so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying. That was his saying all the time, what you do. And so it's what we do, Matthew 5:16, that they may see your good works. You know, they see it. And every once in a while, we have to use some words and we have to share with people. But hopefully it's a better picture. We do a better job of walking it than we do talking it.
Yep, that's excellent. Those are excellent. And I'm with you. You know, there's seasons of life where it might be Jeremiah 29:11, where I have to say, Lord, I don't get this, but I trust the plans you have for me.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a Romans 8:28.
Yes.
You know, there's
yes.
different verses that speak to you at different times. And you right. might be, you know, dreaming, and you might think of Ephesians when God says, or when the Bible says, I can do immeasurably more with you than you can ever think or imagine.
Exactly.
And so there's right. different times where, and that's why committing scripture to memory can be so powerful, so that you can revert back on them when you truly need them. And sometimes it's to kind of propel you on, and not necessarily to dig yourself out of a hole. It's, man, God's going to do
right.
something so incredibly right. powerful that I can't even imagine where this is coming from.
Well, you know, Eric, and that, for me, the first time we got, you know, we're in Washington, man, and that was when we went to Washington, the 2 years I was there with Jim Zorn, man, that was a hornet's nest there, man. That was a growing experience. I will say spiritually, God stretched, you know, because it was, you know, you learned you had to be prayed up, man, because it just, the environment wasn't very good. That I would just put it that way. And so when we finally, I called it a mercy firing. When they finally fired us, you know, I'm driving home. We had played San Diego for our last game. We fly back to Washington and we get back to DC 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And the word was out, Jim was going to get fired. And the verse of scripture that came to my mind. So I'm driving down the road. And I said, God, you said in Ephesians 2:10 that I'm your workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good work that you have prepared ahead of time for me to do. And Eric, people would have thought I was crazy. I'm driving down the road and I'm screaming, show me the work that you have for me to do. Show me the work. I said, you said you prepared works for me to do. Show me the work that you have for me to do. So that verse became a verse that really encouraged me. And I said, God, you said it. So I'm holding you to your word. And that's what God has been doing. So every once in a while, I said, God, show me the work that you have for me to do. You said you prepare works for me to do, and you prepare me for the works. So show me the works.
That's powerful. I'm going to commit that one to memory, and I am going to revert back on that. I appreciate that, Sherman. That made it.
Okay.
Personally just made a big impact on me. All right, we're going to get a few recurring questions, and we'll get you out of here.
Oh, no problem.
First one. Besides the Bible, do you have a favorite book?
I tell you what, I like reading. I like Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life. That book right there, man. You know, I think it's 2000 when it came out. I remember reading that in the very first sentence of the first chapter. I closed the book because that first sentence where it said, it's not about you.
Yep.
Because I'm thinking I'm getting ready to read a book that's getting ready to help me fulfill my purpose, man. Hey, man. And that first sentence said, it's not about you. Whoa, I thought it was. So I'm a Rick Warren fan. I like reading stuff. Tony Evans is one of my favorite authors, you know, Kingdom Man. You know, I like reading his stuff. And so Jerry Bridges, I like reading this stuff, The Pursuit of Holiness, The Discipline of Grace. So I like reading books that it's not so much theology, but the practical application of the principles of God's word. You know, being an offensive guy, you know, Eric, you've been on offense. I like word, you know, it gives you instructions. Here's what we're supposed to do, you know. And so I kind of like that stuff, you know. And so those guys, I really love reading their books.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But a bunch of those right in my queue. I looked to my left because I thought I had Purpose Driven Life. It's somewhere on my bookshelf over here. I was going to hold it up. Shoot, it might be right behind my head somewhere. But anyways, I know it's right around here somewhere because that's one I've gone back to before. What was your first car?
Oh, man. The first car that I bought?
No, first one you ever had.
It's the first one I bought. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It was my rookie year. I didn't have a car or anything until my rookie year. And I bought it was a Cadillac. I bought a big old gray Cadillac. You know, that's what I bought, a Coupe de Ville. It was silver with red leather interior, man. It was cool.
Us Ohio boys, we must be drawn to those Cadillacs. You know, my first car that I ever bought was a Tahoe, and I bought it off a family friend back in Cincinnati. And then my wife's family has the A-Plan through Ford, so I drove a couple Ford trucks. But I always wanted an Escalade. There was something about it. Like, when I was, like, 13 or 14, the Escalades came out. And we didn't have one, but I wanted one. And so I finally, this year, finally got an Escalade.
So, well, I know for me, man, that first, like I said, the first car I got was the one I bought. You know, my parents couldn't afford it, and I was going to college and, you know, didn't have enough money. And so, you know, man, I was so excited. You know, I don't mind saying it. You know, 1976, I'm a second-round draft pick. I wish I was second-round, making money, kind of money second-round draft picks make today. But I was so excited. I'm a second-round draft pick. I get a $25,000 signing bonus. You know, man, I thought I was rich. You know? So I couldn't wait for training camp to break so I could go buy a car. That's all I thought. Man, I get to go buy my first car. And it was a Cadillac Coupe de Ville. And I'll never forget, $13,000 is what that car cost back in 1976. Brand-new Cadillac, $13,000, wow. Man. So I was loving it.
I love it. What's your favorite restaurant?
Oh, man. I think I enjoy really P.F. Chang's here in the Nashville, Franklin area. I really enjoy P.F. Chang's and Jay Alexander. So, you know, I just like a good mixture of food. You know, I like Mexican food. So, you know, there's not many. I'm not a big Italian food guy. You know, that's the one thing. And I don't know why, you know, but I'm just not. But other than that, I think P.F. Chang's, if somebody give me a choice, I'll say, hey, let's go to PF Chang's.
Good deal. All right, last one for me. This is What's Next with Eric Wood. What's next for Sherman Smith? What do you got coming down the line for you?
Well, you know, like I said, I'm still using that Ephesians 2:10, saying, God, show me the work. And so I think God just keeps opening up the doors, Eric, for me to share my faith, share my story. You know, I have an opportunity next week to go to Murray State. Coach Dean Hood has invited me to speak to their team and their staff, and I'm really looking forward to that. Even at my church, I'm an elder at my church, and I think next Sunday, the 24th, I get to, you know, stand in the pulpit and to share the word. And so I just go in there, and it's funny, every time I speak, it's always something related to my experience in coaching, because as Eric, you know, there's so many similarities in football, the preparation, the mindset of a team, of an individual, as it is in the church and as a Christian. And I just see how God has taken so much of that and how they tie together. And so I find myself coaching when I'm speaking, even at church, you know, to encourage us, hey, man, you know, as a football team, you break the huddle. You know, you got to apply what you got in the huddle. As a church, we come to church, we break the huddle. We got to apply what we got in the huddle, you know, so just that kind of stuff. So God has some things where I'm getting to go around and share my faith, you know, a couple things in September. So that's what's been keeping me busy right now.
That's great stuff. I'm so grateful that you get that opportunity, that God is still giving you that work in a different season of life.
Yes.
removed from the game of football, you can use that platform that football gave you to make a kingdom impact. So I'm so grateful that you get that opportunity. And I'm honestly grateful for the time that we get to spend here together today. As soon as we were introduced at church after the service, I wanted to get you on the podcast, but it's one of those deals where it's like, that's not the first question you ask somebody when you meet them. I just wanted to tell you in that moment and find some similar ground with some former teammates of mine that you coach, but I'm so grateful for this opportunity. And I know all the listeners are as well, that you took the time to come on this podcast.
Well, Eric, you know, honestly, like I said, I've said, God, show me the work. And, you know, I don't have a speak, you know, I'm not represented by a speakers bureau. And I said, I'm not going to self-promote. And if, like yourself, if people get a hold of me and say, man, would you do a podcast? Would you, man, I said, God, I said, show me the work. And so this is part of it. So, man, it's a blessing for me to be able to come on your podcast and to spend time with you. And hopefully some of the listeners will be encouraged by some of the things that they heard today.
They absolutely will. Thanks again, Coach.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for tuning into this episode presented, as always, by Punched Energy Chews. If you haven't already, please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Share it on social media as well, and we will share it too. I would also love it if you could pre-order my book, Tackle What's Next. It's on Amazon, and the link to do that is in the show notes. Let's keep making our what's next in life our best yet.